You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, Chris, so let's we're going to start with Ty Lue's return. He is back, going to coach Thursday against the Washington Wizards. That's an 8 p.m. tip for those listening. He has not coached since March 17th because of personal health issues that have really beat him up all year. If anyone that has seen him in pressers, seen him on tape, has been at games, can look at that guy and know he's not feeling well. They're 9-1 with him out under Larry Drew. They have looked very good. I think they. I don't really think that's due to Ty Lue being absent, but Lue's coming back. We knew this was coming. It comes with a few games left in the regular season, just four games left against the Wizards, the Sixers, and then two games against the Knicks to the end of the season. So they're getting back before the playoffs. But what is your reaction to Ty Lue returning, and it really not that long ago since he stepped away to do some very serious sounding health issues?
I hope he's healthy. I really hope he's healthy. I was actually at the game in Orlando where he didn't come back for the second half of that one, and people lost their minds and thought they would actually fire a coach mid-game, which that never ever happens ever and never will happen ever, unless like the coach does something horrifically wrong somehow. And he looks like pale when I saw him going into the locker room after halftime, and he looked pale. It was concerning. And then you saw the reports that he was coughing up blood. It's like, this guy has been coaching this way for months due to lack of sleep. And we saw earlier this season with Steve Clifford and headaches, how stressful the job can be. So to have him coming back so quickly, I just hope he's healthy, and I want him to be healthy, and I want him to be coaching them in the playoffs, because from an analysis standpoint, I think he's a really good playoff coach. He's coached well in the playoffs every single year he's been the head coach of the Cavs.
There are certainly, I think, some things I think that are very fair to critique him about. I think obviously the big concern here is how healthy is he. I think how he looks at the end of this playoff run, because realistically he could be coaching from the middle of April until middle of June. That's another 2 months of work. How is he going to hold up over that when it's the most stressful time of the year, when all of the eyes are on him and LeBron and this Cavs team? I am very curious to see just how that all plays out. I'm curious to see how open he is about this. He owes us as media members, and he owes the fans really nothing. It's his own personal battle. I don't think he owes us a full explanation of what he's going through. I really don't. But I'm very curious to see how he talks about some of this. I do wonder what it tactically will change, if anything. We know he's been in contact with Larry Drew. I kind of wonder if he's going to keep doing some of the things that they've done, that starting Jeff Green, which I think, frankly, is a mistake. I think some of the rotations I want to see how they do, and a lot of this does depend. Just when does George Hill come back? He was not in a boot after the game the other night, but he hasn't been exactly announced his back yet, but they have everybody else. So what does he do with the rotation that's different from Larry Drew? And does he go back to Jetty, who he has developed a liking for? Does some of these little tackle decisions just make? And look, we know that the Cavs have obstacles ahead of them. But one of the big things is that we know that they're probably going to do something different with their defense. David Griffin said recently that they didn't always practice the defense they were going to run in the playoffs until late in the season, and they never used it in the regular season. So they always have this other defensive plan in place. And some of that, I think, is spin, but has to just frankly be, but because they don't practice that much. But it's very curious to me that there's just a lot of tactical things we're going to have. Tyler's going to have to make immediately once coming back. It's not like he gets a month to figure this out. He gets just a handful of games. The Sixers don't have Embiid, but he's got the Wizards, who are fighting for positioning. The Sixers in a very important game for seeding. And then two games to where he might not play that many people, depending on how seeding looks, if he wants to get LeBron or others some rest. It's a tough time for him to come back, but I think it's better that he comes back now than at the end of the regular season or at the beginning of the playoffs.
Personally, I don't think much, if anything, is going to change. I think any decisions Larry Drew has been making have been There may be a couple of decisions he's made that were his own, but I think he's just been following whatever Ty Lue's playbook was. It's similar to how when Steve Kerr left during the playoffs last season, Mike Brown basically just ran his system and played substitute teacher. That's not a discredit to Mike Brown or Larry Drew. That's what the head assistant usually does when they're coaching in place of the head coach, because you don't have time to really change up things or try anything creative. So I think that's more what he's – I don't think anything's really going to change with his return as far as tactics go. He might change – and anything that does change, I don't think it'll be like, oh, that's clearly because Ty Lue came back and he didn't have time to implement that or be a better coach than Larry Drew. I think it'll just be like, oh, they were always going to change that. Like if the defense changes, that'll be because they were always going to change the defense. If they start running different rotations, I think they were always going to do that. I don't think Jeff Green starting or Sheedy Osman playing more is an effect really of Ty Lue or Larry Drew. I think it's just that's what they were doing at the time. And when he left, they didn't really switch anything up, because why rock the boat even more than it is rocked?
Yeah, this is a team that has had a lot of issues. They don't really have a lot of continuity. I mean, Kyle Korver just missed 7 games, and there's a non-zero chance that, there's a non-zero chance that he could like start a shooting guard and depending on how things work out, that in itself is sort of crazy, right? I'm very curious to see what this sort of looks like. I think the obvious thing is going to be. I think the obvious thing is that he is he healthy, and I think he just, if he feels comfortable coming back, that I think we owe him just as a human being like the benefit of the doubt that he is going to be good enough. But I think that's a fair question to ask him. It probably should be the first thing he gets asked is, how are you actually feeling? And I think just in a vacuum that matters more than anything else that's going to be going on. Moving on, looking at these Toronto games that we've seen in the last couple weeks, the Cavs are 2-0 against Toronto, and in both instances have beaten them in ways that were crushing for Toronto. The big comeback in game one, and then a pretty dominant-ish win on Tuesday night in Cleveland. Chris, what do you actually feel like you can take away from those games? You and I have talked about this off the podcast, but what do you actually feel like is valuable from those two games? Like, is there anything you actually can like learn about either of these teams and how they would match up in the playoffs right now based on those two games? I tend to say that there's very little tangibly that we can learn about the X's and O's of the game, but I think it's a reminder of certain things that, like, Toronto has no one that can guard LeBron, and they're going to have issues with Kevin Love. I think there's little things that matter, but nothing broadly, I think, that is new or valuable.
I think Cleveland did send the message of we are still the favorites. They've proven that, yes, the trades seem to be working out. They are still the favorite in the East. They still have LeBron James. They're still the best team. When pre-trade deadline, there was a lot of concern that they might not even make the conference finals. They looked so miserable and were playing so horrible. That said, as far as an actual playoff series matchup goes, I don't think we can gauge that much, particularly from the second game. I think the first game, the first win, I think we can gauge more from that, just because it felt like they were, just from watching it, it felt like they were more engaged. It felt like they cared a little more. From the opening of the second one, it very much felt like both teams were playing, okay, there's a very good chance we meet each other again in the playoffs. It's April. We're going to keep what we got close to our chest. Like, I think some of the opening passes LeBron made were hysterical. He was trying stuff that he always tries weird stuff, but he was trying passes that even by his standards were like, really? You're going to try that pass? And it just felt like he was not taking it as seriously as he could. He obviously stepped up in the big moments at the end and was just, as Larry Nance put it, he's stronger and bigger than them. So he was able to take over and prove that, yes, he can still beat them. But it didn't feel like either team was running anything substantial as far as a matchup goes. And obviously, regular season is different than the playoffs. In the playoffs, you specifically designed yourself to beat the other team, to exploit mismatches, to play against their weaknesses to your advantages, which that's going to matter a lot, especially when we see stuff like, who's really going to guard LeBron? Can Serge Ibaka really handle Kevin Love? These are legitimate questions. Can they even play Jonas Valanciunas in late game situations, especially against someone like Larry Nance? Like, those are legitimate questions that the Raptors are going to have to ask themselves. So I think stuff like that is interesting, but I don't think the games really showed much as far as how a potential series would go, just because in the regular season, it's much different, especially in that final game where it kind of felt like the Cavs were just a better team at freelancing around.
who is Toronto's best option to defend LeBron in your mind? Because I like, there's not necessarily. Well, yeah, obviously.
The foul line, the refs.
Well, the foul line gets you tricky, because if you just keep fouling, you're going to be stuck with CJ Miles on LeBron, and then you're just kind of like, no, I love CJ Miles, but.
They need to do that old Shaq tactic where they just have like 20 different wings on the roster specifically meant to foul.
I mean, if they have to, just use up Norm Powell's minutes by just him hacking LeBron for like 4 minutes. Because, I mean, like, frankly, you probably would get some instances where LeBron doesn't get a call just because he just shrugs through Norman Powell. You know, like that.
That's been an issue with him all season.
Exactly. Throwing it to OG Anunoby is very bold, because he's obviously talented. He's had a good rookie season. He's clearly just kind of twitchy around LeBron, and understandably so. And he just hasn't quite. He has nothing that really, I think, threatens LeBron in a way. Like, LeBron toys with him. And I think Pascal Siakam, as good as he was in that first game against LeBron in fighting, I think he's kind of in the same situation where he just can't hang either. He might be their best bet, but then are you playing him at the three? Like, what does that look like for Toronto? That gets into some weird lineup things, and I think that plays into the Cavs' favor to a large degree. That Serge Ibaka has not played well against the Cavs in those last two games, and Kevin Love has just thoroughly outplayed him. Has just been the only two things that seem to matter to me. Like, I don't, like, Kyle Lowry was clearly just very much still enjoying that Villanova title win on Tuesday. DeMar DeRozan was not really fully at his best in that game. Jose Calderon's probably not going to drop 19 points on Toronto in the playoffs. He's probably
don't
not going
to ever doubt Jose Calderon ever again. I mean, Calderon.
The Cavs are. I'm going to pull it up right now because I can't remember the record, because I saw this like at 1:30 in the morning after the game.
They've lost like five games where he's been the starter.
Brian Winters tweeted this last night. The Cavs being 23-9 with Jose Calderon as a starting point guard is a ridiculous summation of their ridiculous regular season. It's pretty accurate, but he had 19 points in this game. I can imagine he's maybe even playing 19 minutes or half of 19 minutes or anything in the playoffs when these two teams play again. I'm a little concerned about Clarkson, I guess, as well in that potential matchup, but I don't think there's much I really look at this and say, okay, all of this really matters. And that I just feel like all we really have to remind ourselves is that they don't have an answer for LeBron, and that just might be enough. Which sucks for Toronto, because this is a very good team. But that could legitimately be the answer, and that's kind of deflating it for them.
If there is there's no such thing as LeBron stopper, so we can just throw that out there. Like, PJ Tucker ain't walking through that door, which he wasn't a LeBron stopper.
Look, the Cavs could really use a PJ Tucker instead of Jeff Green, but PJ Tucker is like a good team defender, good overall defender. Not stopping guys like LeBron,
That's because there's maybe two players in the NBA that could that can stop LeBron, and one of them is on Golden State, and the other, and even then he can't do it, and then the other is currently nursing a mystery calf injury, and even then he just merely slows him down, air quotes, as opposed to stopping him.
Paul George isn't on your list. That's interesting. I would have him as the third guy. I would be him, Draymond, Kawhi, and
not this season, just because I don't think OKC uses him that way.
That's fair. I think like if in a vacuum, if I was gonna like pick guys, those would be the only three, I think.
Draymond, Kawhi, and Paul George.
Yeah, and I'd maybe like dare Giannis to do it because they ask him to do it, but he's not quite there defensively yet.
Much
in offense. He's got like the body type to do it, but he's not there as like a skilled defender just yet.
Or really with just strength. Giannis is a guy who's as strong as he is. He's still just mainly length, which that's fine. But LeBron can. He's one of those guys where he can just shrug you off, and it's like you bounce off to his body because he's just made of nothing but muscle. It's insane. As far as actual options to what they can throw to him, I think their best bet is probably Siakam. I don't think that means he's going to slow him down. I don't think that means he's going to stop him. But there are two kinds of defenders. This is absolutely hopeless to the point where the Cavs are just going to ISO and force him and exploit it for the 6 minutes or whatever they're on the floor. And then we're going to actually force LeBron to run the offense because he'll get tired and he doesn't want to deal with it. I think Siakam can make him do that. And I think that's more valuable than the average defender just merely trying to exist against him, because like we've established, no one can stop him, but you can at least force him to not be, you can force him to not let yourself be an exploitative mismatch, which that's what you kind of have to do in the playoffs. You have to not be a mismatch that's just going to be picked on all game long, which that could end up happening to Serge Ibaka.
Yeah, Ibaka's like a real, that contract is wild to me. and just his fit in that series is very interesting to me. I love it. The five is interesting, and I also just can't imagine. Like, I really wonder if they're going to try to use Jeff Green as the Rosen stopper, because I feel really weird about that. Because I think the Cavs are very clearly, you know, at their best with their
I don't think they want LeBron on him, though.
No, but I think that their best starting five is very clearly George Hill. Insert your shooting guard of choice. LeBron James, Kevin Love at the four, and Nance at the five. I think that's clearly their best starting five.
Well, I think you can close with that. I don't know if you... Like, does, I have to really start with it.
But I like really like Nance and Love together. The passing's really good.
No, I love it too. It's incredible.
I don't know if it's like worth like not starting with it to like to not to have a more physical advantage against, you know, DeRozan. And I just think that lineup is just like it's like I think it just has to be there. And like that to me, like that we haven't seen it is in a larger dose is a little weird to me. And that Toronto game, for example, it played maybe like 6 minutes together, and I don't have that exactly the exact tabulation, but it didn't start. It didn't start the second half.
It's possible they just get tired, to be honest.
And like the injuries and stuff matter too, but like I just don't really like Jeff Green is as your DeRozan stopper is like a weird thing. Like I've already braced myself for the possibility that we're gonna see like 45 minutes of Jeff Green guarding Kevin Durant and like 45 minutes of him guarding James Harden. I've just braced myself for that, but I will never be able to rationalize that as like a good sound basketball decision.
I'm honestly more thinking about how they're going to handle the bench, because they can beat the starting lineup just because of having LeBron, but I'm interested how they'll perform in the playoffs. But Toronto's bench has been where they've really been winning games this year, and I think one thing they might want to do is run Larry Nance with LeBron staggered into the bench unit, kind of what they used to do with when they used to have a LeBron stagger with the bench unit, and then they'd have Kyrie and Love come out first or second, or LeBron come out first. However they used to run that, it's been a while. They'd stagger LeBron with the bench unit. I think if they stagger LeBron and Nance with the bench unit, they'd be able to really diffuse some of those advantages they have, especially the bigger, sizier lineups they have in the backcourt or in the frontcourt. I think that'd be interesting to see them try.
I also think they have to like probably start Kevin Love to start the fourth quarter. I don't know why they're running these lineups where it's no LeBron, no Love, and it's Jordan Clarkson is your offensive engine for 5 minutes. And yes, that's going to get shrunk in the playoffs, but I just don't really buy that as a way to survive. Toronto.
Well, I think that rotation is changing in the playoffs, like 100%.
I just think like I need to see it before like I believe that they're actually going to do it, because I think the staggering has to get different. I think if you're like Love and Thompson together to start the fourth is probably what I would do. And if you're going to play Clarkson there, fine. Play Korver there, fine. Maybe Hood makes sense there, maybe JR makes sense there, whatever. I think that's kind of what they have to do. That's like really all I take away. Is there anything else that you've seen from the Cavs of like tactically that you're like, oh, that's interesting to me, aside from, you know, maybe just actually them being healthy, because they actually are as close to healthy as they've been in a long time right now?
I think anything interesting that we're going to see out of any tactical lineups will probably happen when they sweep whoever they play in the first round, like they always do.
So, looking at those first round series, though, they can.
How is that for a transition? Like, I'm very upset that you did not acknowledge it, and I'm acknowledging it myself because I have a giant ego.
I smiled when you did that. I'm appreciative. Miami, Milwaukee, Washington. Right now, the Cavs, I think like if the odds would say that they are like likelier to end up as the four seed. I might be wrong about that just because of the Philly schedule the rest of the way, even without Embiid. It looks like the Heat have the inside track on the sixth seed, the Wizards at seven, the Bucks at eight. They're all tied in terms of record right now, all 42-36. And the crazy amount of tiebreakers will sort that out. But depending on if the Cavs are three or if they're four, or if Indiana, I guess, leaps up somehow and ends up being not the five seed, which seems very unlikely at this point. Out of those three teams, how would you rank them? How would you order those teams in terms of the Cavs should want to face Team X in round one? Or it probably doesn't matter, but is there one matchup that you're very interested in seeing above the others?
I want to see them play Washington. I don't think you want to play Miami, just because even though Miami probably won't stand a chance against him, LeBron's never won in Miami since coming back to Cleveland, and I find that weird.
It's one of the most bizarre stats that, like, I've seen. It's just it makes sense when you go back and look at some of the games they've had. They've all had these very weird performances there. There's the Christmas Day game. There's just the game they played in the middle of this very good stretch of basketball, where the one crappy game is the Miami game. It has the weight, like, Wade's on that team, and apparently, like, is in much better. There's a Sirat Sohai story at SB Nation that came out on Wednesday that I'll put in the show notes, where it's about Wade, and he basically showed up in Miami with, like, 9% body fat, and that was, like, good for the Cavs, but the Heat are like, no, like, you're out of shape. And he was, like, the chunkiest guy on the team when he arrived. I'm like, okay, like, that, like, there's just this difference in the two teams' mindsets and their personnel right now. That could be fascinating in its own right, just the Wade LeBron weirdness of it all.
Right, but I think that's just, if you could avoid that, I would. That's my personal opinion. I think you never want to play Giannis, just because as bad as the Bucks are, and they are by far the worst team in the East, I don't care what their seeding ends up being, they are the worst team in the East because their scheme is terrible and they just aren't very good, in my opinion. They still have one of the best players in the conference who has the best ability to carry a team to wins and carry a team out of a series. He's not carrying anyone. Giannis isn't carrying anyone out of the first round this year, but he could make them, the Cavs, really have a pain of a time in the first round. I think the way they play is terrible. I also think it's just something you don't really want to deal with. It's annoying playing an aggressive trapping defense early in the playoffs, like they're going to have to deal with if they would play Milwaukee. So I personally would not do that. I would just avoid it. Washington, I feel like they're imploding. They've had a lot of injuries. John Wall has not looked like himself all year. They look like they don't like each other. They keep sniping comments. And earlier in the season, they said they were the best team in the Eastern Conference, and I think everyone in Cleveland was listening to that, and I think they're going to blow them out so freaking hard in the first round as a message that it's going to make it might get Scott Brooks fired, and it might make the team and like get blown up. Like, I think if they want any matchup, they should play Washington and just absolutely embarrass them, and I think they would.
Washington would have no one to guard. No one to guard LeBron, which is a huge plus. I think Kevin Love would have be in a position.
Otto Porter Jr. just got hurt recently too, didn't he?
It's possible. As someone who's like less and less partaking in Twitter, I like feel like I found out about Embiid the next morning, and I was like, oh, this is like very weird to feel about this. So he, you know, he played. So he injured his ankle 5 days ago, but he played against the Rockets.
It looks like he came back, so he's fine.
But still, like that's still like no offense to Otto Porter, who's a very good player, but he's just not defending LeBron. I think that the Heat's not quite there as it used to be. It kind of be like a lukewarm fire between those two teams. I kind of would like to just see the Heat just because I think it'd be fascinating. I don't think it quite matters.
Narratives would be fun.
Yeah.
Wade versus LeBron, all that stuff.
Yeah, and it gives me an excuse to talk to Wes and David from Locked On Heat, and I think they're very nice. Good, they're very nice guys. The Bucks series would be interesting just because like it is Giannis, and I wonder if there's tactically, that series could be interesting enough for me just because it's a good fast mile of like what they would use Jeff Green as, because they have Jabari and they have Middleton, so they have these bigger guys that are going to play in the perimeter and be a big part of the offense. That framework of what the Bucks have would force the Cavs to like do what they would do against some other teams and like have to just, like give us an idea of how they're going to deploy Jeff Green. No, I don't think any of their teams are really built like that. So that in itself might be worth it alone, just to see how they would use Jeff Green when if he's guarding Giannis, if you know where they would put LeBron, and or how they would use Jeff Green in other ways. I just kind of think that might tip their hand the most in terms of what they would do against someone like Houston or someone like. Someone like maybe the Celtics, if they even get that far, or more than anybody, Golden State, because of how Golden State plays and how they have Durant and all these bigger wings.
I guess, yeah, that's possible that we could see that. And like you said, and like I said earlier, the first round really is a tune-up series for them. That's what it always is. Yeah, I mean, Giannis could be a decent start-off point to see. Maybe this is how they run Jeff Green against the opposing star, especially if LeBron's going to do the free safety thing that he's been doing for so long and seems to be their primary defense, at least so far this season. They might change that up for the playoffs. They've done that in the past. And he is someone that can kind of let LeBron take a rest as opposed to constantly having him play against the other team's best player. I just personally think that if you want to avoid teams with better players early in the playoffs, just because, especially when you're using it as a tune-up series like they so typically do, that you avoid it. And obviously that kind of goes – now, most of the East is actually better than it's been in the past, which if that's the case, you want Miami because they probably have the least amount of stars of any team. But I just think that Milwaukee plays the style that's such a pain to play against. They're so – like, they're not good, but they're so annoying. And plus, Matthew Dellavedova isn't on that team, and you never know what he's going to do, so – I think it'd be interesting to see Jeff Green against Giannis and kind of get that idea. Like, okay, how is this defense actually going to work? I just don't know if I'd want that series. If you told me to pick a series, Milwaukee would probably be the one I want the least just because of Giannis.
I think that's fair. I think it would maybe be similar to what the Cavs had last year in facing the Pacers in round one, and they had Paul George, and that ended up being nothing, really. I mean, it was close some games, but it didn't really matter that much. And so maybe that's what it is, but who knows. Chris, wrap it up on this. This is not necessarily related to the Cavs, but we saw you and I are talking about this, and I have a take on this, so I just kind of want to talk about it. The 2K draft for teams, esports teams, happened. I'm going to pull up and tell you how much they're making, because that's kind of the point here. But it happened. This is how many teams are investing in. They are putting a lot of money into this 2K league. It's esports are very popular right now. These are guys that are, I mean, they're playing NBA 2K for a living. The Cavs are one of the teams that have it. So per this article from Hoops Hype, each player in the 2K league signs a 6-month contract. If you're picked in the first round, you're making $35,000. Every other player makes $32,000, and for 6 months of work. And there's also $1 million prize pool that's spread out across in 3 in-season tournaments and postseason. So if you are on a good team and you end up winning a lot, you're going to make a bunch of money. I just want to point this out and say, clarify with this one point. I do not begrudge them for making money. That would be a silly thing. If you're making money for something that you're good at, I feel like you should get paid money for it.
And esports makes money.
Right. But here's my thing. That is more money. Two-way players in the NBA make a minimum of $75,000. So there are 60 guys that are playing it, played a lot of minutes in the G League this year with Quinn Cook as the guy who's, congrats to Quinn Cook. Shouts to him for getting that multi-year contract, even if it's minimum and a time when the ahead of a crunch salary summer. I don't know exactly what the numbers are this year, but I can't imagine they've jumped. But last year, the maximum salary in the G League was $26,000. The minimum and the other salary option was $19,000. So these guys that are in the 2K League are making more than that. The G League players do not get money for making a run in the postseason. The G League playoffs do not net you more money, even though those are the games actually shown, not shown on Facebook Live or Twitch, but shown on ESPN or ESPN3, right? Like they are shown via a or ESPN2 or whatever it is. Those are actually broadcast. This is also a league that has been branded the G League. It was the D League by Gatorade, a company worth $4.8 billion. That is billion with a B. And they didn't get a salary bump from that, as far as we know, at least not one that is going to significantly change what it means. I don't begrudge the 2K guys for getting their money. They're good at it. They draw in money, as you said. I just think it's absurd that G Leaguers are not getting paid a workable living wage for doing what they're doing. If they're doing this and they're participating in the system, they should be getting paid like an actual salary to do this, I think, personally. And I don't know how you can have like a real minor league unless you're paying guys enough where it's worth it for them to participate, sign with your team, get in your system, as opposed to going overseas. Like if you're not a surefire NBA guy, I know this from covering guys at Ohio University. You know this from just being everyone knows this as a basketball fan. Guys can make more money by going and playing overseas for a year and taking their chance by playing in some country they've never been to and playing in far away from home by playing in, or they get more money that way than doing this. It's a hard buy in to make 19 grand if you have maybe can make 50 overseas. It for if you're someone like DJ Cooper, for example, was an Ohio University legend, I think could have been an NBA player. He got paid a lot of money right away to go overseas after it was big for 2 years at Ohio. And he's now making $100,000 playing in France because he went overseas and made a name for himself there. I would guarantee you that he, like, from talking to his agent in the past, that that's someone who would have liked to stay at home, be near his son, and, like, live in the United States if he can make similar money. But you can't do that in the G League. And I just think it's crazy that, like, immediately these guys that are playing 2K are making more money than G Leaguers. That just seems very silly to me.
So I think that the players making more money than them, the elite, the 2K players making more money than the G League players, that isn't as stunning to me just because of the absurd amounts of money that esports brings in. Like, I'm not surprised that they're making more, but I do think that there is an overall point here of how the G League doesn't pay their top players that much. If you're going to be the top developmental league of the NBA, which is the best basketball league in the world, everyone wants to be in the NBA. The best players play in the NBA. There's a reason that at the end of the year, whoever wins in the NBA are considered world champions, because that is the best place to play in the world. No one comes close. If you're going to be that top developmental league and make it and create this appearance of, oh, this is where we develop our young talent, this is where players can, if they choose, not go to college, but instead play here and make some money in that single year, which Adam Silver is always talking about how he wants to increase the age limit rule instead of reducing it. It's ridiculous that a $1 billion industry that made the dumbest name switch in the history of name switches, adding G League to her Gatorade for a branding BS, can't afford to pay players above what they're currently making. Just absolutely ridiculous. And I understand that there's a situation where it's like, yes, they don't bring in as much money. That still doesn't change the fact that this organization could be paying more money if the NBA would just put more money into it. And trust me, the NBA is making enough money to put into it. This esports stuff, as much money as it's going to make, it makes it on its own, and they can afford to live it on their own. If you're going to have something like the G League, you should support it yourself. You should raise it up yourself. You should make it to where it's a viable option, especially when we have all this stuff in the NCAA every year about players illegally being paid, which that's a stupid concept. They should be getting paid anyways, but that's a whole other podcast. And it's ridiculous that the NBA thinks it could just have this league and it's not even close to, like, it's not even, like, the third best. Like, Australia, Europe, the NCAA are the better leagues to not only get paid in, but for development, for
comfort of living. Comfort of living. Like, just think about
it. We're crying out loud. At least you get a place to live and some food when you go to college. If you go to the G League, you might not even get that.
So you get a home and
relocation payments in this 2K thing. Like, they have better benefits. They have great benefits. Now, maybe the G League's offering that. We haven't seen the contract details. But, like, they have all these awesome benefits, and they're being paid more? Like, come on. The NBA can't give the G League more money after giving them this stupid Gatorade name for a year? Really? Like, it's honestly the biggest sham of the NBA. Of, like, I love the NBA, but, like, we always talk about, like, it's the best league. There's nothing wrong with it. They're constantly above progressive. They're progressively above everyone, and that's awesome. But they have this whole minor league that they pretend to care about, and they really don't. They don't care about it. They're happy using the NCAA as a free minor development league, and they're perfectly fine surviving on that. And it's just dumb because then they brand it this way, which. And then they rename it to something stupid and can't even give it that much money.
Got a training center out of it, though. And look, I mean, like, thinking about Quinn Cook for a second, it's sort of like a minor miracle that he stuck it out like he did, right? Like, I don't know, like, his financial background or anything like that, so I can't, like, speak to the fact. Like, maybe there's something there. But this is a guy who was the best player on the Ken Charge for, like, two seasons, was a G League All-Star Game MVP, took forever to stick with the team. He's just now getting a deal, and he's in the, like, a young player who's 25 years old. He's just now getting a guaranteed contract. It's sort of like a miracle that a guy like that didn't say, okay, I'm gonna go get paid, right? Like, it is sort of crazy in a lot of ways that a guy was probably making $26,000 into money on 10-day deals and stuck it out and didn't just go overseas to go make $100,000 playing in France or something like that. Just so he could, just by the sheer fact that he can make more money. That in itself is a very telling thing. That a guy like that has to like basically just not make a lot of money for 2 years until he gets a two-way deal. And like, yes, $75,000 is good, and yes, like those guys that rack up a lot of NBA days make more money. Lennon Perantes and John Holland, the days they've been with the Cavs recently, have certainly netted themselves more money for this year, and that in itself is good, and they get to around NBA teams in a personal way. You can if you're playing overseas, but it's just not a lot of money. And like I really, really feel for guys that just, like, if you're a part of this billion-dollar system that has a billions, multi-billion-dollar company paying for things, like you said, it's a sham. And I think at the end of the day, that if this was like a truly like fully like progressive league, those guys probably get paid more. No, if this was like a fully on,
I'm not even asking for like a huge pay raise. Just 35K is fine.
Like, yeah, like just bump them so like they're making like yeah, just like give it like so it's like a livable wage. Like it's not like they're asking for like the best guy in the G League should make $1 million. I don't know if anyone's arguing that, but like
right, because they don't bring in $1 million. But like come no. on, like
yeah, it's silly. Chris, probably put up on this. What seed do the Cavs get? 1, 3, or 4? Where do they end up?
Let me pull up the standings really quick. You're putting me on the spot. Let's see. They are half a game above the Sixers. The Sixers don't have Joel Embiid. Sixers schedule really quick. The Sixers play Detroit. They play Cleveland, Dallas, Atlanta, and Milwaukee. Wow. That's really favorable to them, actually. Because I was going to say, well, no, they're going to play Cleveland if Cleveland cares. I think it comes down to if Cleveland cares. If Cleveland cares enough to beat Philadelphia, they will win. They will get the 3 seed. If they decide we're just going to cruise to the end of the season, whatever happens, happens, then they'll get the 4. I think they want to get the 3 seed, though, personally. So I think they're going to get 3.
I buy that theory. I think they're going to get 3 as well, but I think the winner of Friday's game gets a 3 seed. So, Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
No problem.